Welcome to RTP TV. I'm Neil Love, and tonight, in our eighth webcast in a row, and our final one, chronic myeloid leukemia, fascinating topic that seems to be getting more and more interesting every day. As we've done in our prior webcasts, we're going to really string this whole discussion tonight around faculty cases. We have six cases that we're going to use. If you have any questions you'd like to see the faculty address or any comments, just type it into the lower left part of your screen and we'll see how many of these we can deal with. Here's sort of where we're heading. The first two topics are major issues in terms of choice of initial TKI up front, monitoring, and we're also going to talk about side effects and adherence and a couple other topics. But first, let me just turn to Susan O'Brien and ask you, I'm kind of curious the questions that you get from physicians in practice about CML and how they line up with what we have identified as our top three, which is choice of TKI, monitoring, and adherence.
I think that those are clearly the three most important. We're lucky enough to have a number of very good choices. How do we make the choice between the TKIs? Monitoring has become more complicated over time compared to the old days. And what to do in terms of making sure that the patient's really taking their drug. I think these are the most important questions.
So Neil Shah, in a second, we're going to let you briefly present two patients who presented and kind of use that as a focal point to talk about initial therapy and choice of TKI. But again, just sort of taking a step back as you hear questions from oncologists in practice and see patients, what are some of the areas that you think maybe we should try to clarify tonight?
Well, I think these are certainly the most common areas that probably more than 95% of the questions surround one of these three areas. The only other thing I would add would be that we sometimes get asked about the appropriate timing for allogeneic stem cell transplantation, but that's something that we're deferring more and more because we have a multitude of highly effective oral agents at the present time.
So in a second, we'll have Neil present his case, and actually we're going to have the audience respond to it and see what they might do in a patient like this. I'll also mention that we surveyed 25 community-based oncologists this week, and we're going to bring in their comments and their questions and their perceptions about this disease as we go through tonight. So Neil, can you briefly tell us about this 18-year-old patient?
Yeah, so this patient, this is a case, I guess, if you will, of lightning striking twice to a young man, 18 years old, and had been diagnosed with an atypical form of cystic fibrosis just a couple years earlier. And so he was getting monitored regularly, blood counts and the like, and had an asymptomatic leukocytosis, and as usual, was worked up for infection and so on, subsequently referred to my pediatric colleagues, and they diagnosed him as having a BCR-ABL positive myeloproliferative disorder. And you can see that his presenting features were kind of typical of a patient who has no symptoms. Essentially just the incidental leukocytosis, mild thrombocytosis was observed as well, and his bone marrow biopsy was consistent with chronic phase CML, and the Philadelphia chromosome was detected in all metaphases and analysis, which is typical for this disease. You got a quick glimpse of his peripheral blood, and this is a sign of, this is showing you the Philadelphia chromosome in the lower central part. You can see the chromosome translocation between chromosomes 9 and 22, which results in the fusion of the BCR-enabled gene in a pathologic sense.
Anything else you want to say about him personally, Neil? I mean, 18 years old, just starting college is kind of a tough time, or any time is a tough time to contemplate this diagnosis. But any specific impressions you had of him?
Well, certainly, you know, he was concerned. I think even more so, his mother was extremely concerned because she had had, you know, already this one issue to deal with cystic fibrosis, and now getting told that her son had a form of leukemia on top of that certainly made her understandably very anxious. But I think we had a very lengthy conversation that first day about what to expect, if he tolerates therapy well, if he responds well. And this is really giving us a glimpse into the future where we feel comfortable treating a young individual like this with tyrosine kinase inhibitor therapy as first-line therapy, as opposed to taking such a patient to allogeneic stem cell transplantation like we would have done probably just 10 to 15 years ago.
So in a second, we're going to see how the audience would likely manage this 18-year-old man while they're voting. Susan, how would you be thinking through this case?
Well, I would generally start with the second-generation TKI, and most of the time it's a flip of the coin, to be honest with you. I think here, what I might be thinking about a little bit more based on the patient's age, being only 18, is the adherence to treatment. And given that the dasatinib is once a day and nilotinib is twice a day, as I think we're going to talk about, in this specific case where you're dealing with a teenager, I might be looking more towards the once-a-day dosing.
So Neil, maybe you can talk a little bit about what actually happened with this patient.
Yeah, that actually, what Susan mentioned, you know, did factor into the decision process. But, you know, I look at, and we're going to go over the data, I'm sure, in a few minutes, but I look at the two second generation drugs as being essentially equivalent in previously untreated patients. And so I present the efficacy data essentially that way, and we talk about some of the salient distinguishing features, and amongst them are the once daily with or without food for dasatinib versus twice daily on an empty stomach. And an 18-year-old college freshman, I didn't try to steer him myself, but when he heard about that, you know, he thought, you know, he'd want to try the once daily drug, and he did in fact start on dasatinib.
And you can see the audience actually seems like a little bit more swayed toward nilotinib, but still 75% of the audience choosing a second generation TKI. So before we go into your contrasting case, Neil, current status of this patient?
So the patient's done remarkably well. He's actually had a major molecular response achieved in a very short period of time after 6 months and is tolerating therapy extremely well and is doing well at school too, all of which are making his mother a lot less anxious and certainly a lot happier.
Always good to keep the parents and the mom happy. And we are going to talk about monitoring of patients like this. But before we do, just again, to kind of bring in the spectrum of, you know, from a human patient care point of view, your second case, Neil.
Yeah, so this is somebody at the other end of the career schedule. This is a 59-year-old physician who had worked in the military and was retired, which is a painful reminder to all of us in practice that had we gone into the military, we'd probably all be retired at such a young age. But you can see that he actually presented with more substantial disease burden, a white count approaching 200,000 with 5% blasts, a good number of basophils, some anemia, and substantial thrombocytosis. He again had a marrow consistent with chronic phase CML and the detection of the Philadelphia chromosome in all cells. And this is just a sign of his peripheral blood, actually, that had a large number of immature granulocytes. But again, nothing to suggest that he had blast phase disease. He had chronic phase disease with just a very high white count.
So we're going to again ask the audience how they would be thinking this through and then go to Susan. But first, Neil, any comorbidities at all?
Yeah, so this patient actually had a number of comorbidities. He had been hospitalized about a year earlier for some surgical issues, and he developed ARDS. He had reflux disease, for which he was on proton pump inhibitor therapy. So he had a few other things ongoing, actually.
So when you assessed him, particularly in terms of cardiorespiratory and pulmonary after the ARDS, at that point, any specific issues or concerns?
Well, from that perspective, he was doing okay. But with that history, it did factor in a little bit to my choice of therapy, certainly.
So, Susan, how would you be thinking through? You can see, again, the audience mainly talking about one of the second-generation agents, a little bit more in terms of nilotinib. But how would you be thinking through this case?
Well, since he was in the military, I wouldn't be worrying about compliance in this case. But I don't know the full story of the ARDS. That might make me a little anxious in terms of did he have any residual lung damage and how would that be impacted if he was one of the minority of patients that were to develop a pleural effusion on dasatinib. So maybe in this case, I might be leaning a little bit more towards the nilotinib depending on what his underlying pulmonary status was.
So, Neil, maybe you can follow up in terms of what happened with this man.
Yeah, the other issue that I alluded to is he was on a proton pump inhibitor, and that's known to actually diminish the absorption of dasatinib. So it's not dangerous from a toxicity perspective, but you do worry a little bit that the patient may get a subtherapeutic dose. And so for that, and the reason that Susan mentioned that twice daily on an empty stomach for this particular individual, you know, clearly posed no problems whatsoever, he elected to go on nilotinib therapy and has actually also done very well, has achieved a complete cytogenetic response after 6 months of therapy and is tolerating the therapy, is having some issues with rash and headache, but otherwise is doing reasonably well.
So we want to bring in also as part of this discussion before we get into some of the key data, what we learned from these 25 oncologists in practice. I should mention these are all docs who'd work with us on education programs, presenting cases, et cetera. I would say probably maybe a little bit better informed than the average oncologist, busier, successful docs, but you know, certainly very high end, if you want to use that word, oncologists. There are 25 of them. We surveyed them in the last week. We asked them, how many cases do you have of CML in your practice? On average, it's about 9. So we have more than 200 cases. Almost all of these patients are on TKIs. And from their assessment, and we'll talk a little bit about this later, about 15% from their point of view, they thought were having problems with adherence. Here you can see the breakdown of which TKIs they were receiving. Of course, a lot of these patients, we don't know right now because we didn't ask that, were probably treated, or at least started on treatment in the pre-second generation age, but two-thirds of them were on imatinib. When we asked these docs, right now, what do you consider to be, you know, your primary TKI up front? And you can see that 85% of them said either nilotinib, dasatinib, or coin flip. And we actually gave both of you the survey, and both of you answered a coin flip also. And we'll kind of pursue that as we go through some of these data. But let's talk first a little bit about monitoring of these patients. Susan, you have the interesting pleasure of being the head of the NCCN committee, and Neil, you're on the committee, so you've had a chance to really think through how to communicate these things. I want to start out with Susan and just, you know, sort of basically give us a broad description of, you know, how you approach this. And while we're doing that, we're going to ask the audience this question. We want you to assume that you have a patient like one of Neil's patients who's been started on a TKI, who's now out at 3 years in major molecular response, tolerating treatment well, not having any adherence problems that you could assess. And our question is, and also in CCYR, in general, at this point in time, how often would you be ordering a quantitative PCR? And while they're voting, Susan, maybe you can just provide a capsule viewpoint of how you approach monitoring and maybe some of the misconceptions you see out there.
Well, I think the gold standard is still complete cytogenetic response, and that may change over time with longer follow-up. But right now, patients who achieve that response have an excellent long-term outcome. I think the important thing about PCR monitoring is that you can't really just look at the specific value and always know what to do. The key is it going up or is it going down? I think a rule of thumb is if it's going down, good. If it's stable, that's okay. If it's going up, by itself, that doesn't make you declare the patient a failure. What it does is make you then look to see if they're losing their response on a cytogenetic basis. And so the key is that the PCR is something that guides you potentially to change your therapy only when you've backed up that rise in the PCR with an actual cytogenetic analysis and not necessarily changing based on the PCR by itself. I think that's a very important point.
So Neil, maybe you can talk a little bit about the usual patient who gets a TKI like your two patients and sort of the milestone over the first 18 months of what you normally see. And then comment on the issue of, again, you get out 3 years like this poll question, and you can actually see the audience is kind of split about whether every 3 or 6 months. But any comments, Neil, about the first critical 18 months?
Well, I think what we've learned pretty convincingly from the imatinib era is that, at least on imatinib, if patients are in the minority, but there is a substantial proportion who will not do well on imatinib and will lose response, the majority of that action occurs within the first 3 years. And that puts the onus, I think, on us, the treating physicians, to really make sure that during the first 3 years, they're being adequately monitored. And the NCCN guidelines are available online. Certainly, bone marrow assessments every 6 months are recommended until achievement of a complete cytogenetic response is obtained. And then also simultaneous with that is quarterly quantitative PCR. So that can be done on the peripheral blood. It's an easy thing to do. And I certainly do it quarterly. I think if you get out to 3 years and beyond and a patient has a very stable response and you think the patient is very adherent with therapy and reliable, I think you can make an argument that going to every 6 months is justifiable simply because in that depth of response, the overwhelming majority of these responses are very stable.
So, Susan, I was kind of interested in our poll of oncologists. We asked them, what's your comfort level in terms of ordering and interpreting CML assays? I mean, again, I can tell you that a lot of these were very prominent oncologists, and about half of them kind of admitted to having some level of confusion. I'm curious, Susan, where do you think the confusion is?
Well, I think that to be fair to people in practice, they're getting a little bit of a mixed message from the academic community. There are some people who are very focused on major molecular response and other people who've said, as I've just said, as long as you have a complete cytogenetic response and the PCR is not rising, you're fine. And so there is, I think, a little bit of a mixed message about what is the endpoint that you want to get to. And then there's also the issue of what defines a major molecular response, because most of these standard labs don't do the correction for the international scale. And so that's another issue that makes it a little bit confusing for somebody who's not in an academic center to be able to interpret the PCR. So I think there are aspects of the monitoring that can make it confusing. And I think, again, one of the important things to remember is that if it's going up, you don't want to just necessarily act on one PCR. You need to see the trend over time, and then that should trigger you to look at the cytogenetics.
And, you know, we're not going to go through piece by piece the exact, you know, recommendations out there. As we always do with our webcast, I'm going to send out an email in about a week announcing the rebroadcast of this. If you want to look at it again or recommend it to one of your colleagues, you know, you can take a closer look at these. We also have the ELN criteria. But I want to kind of get more of a conceptual portrait from the two of you about these assays. But first, Neil, do you agree with Susan's thought that you don't change therapy unless you go back and redo the cytogenetics, get another bone marrow?
If there is a convincing rise, some have said, you know, a five-fold increase is convincing in their particular assay. I think in general practice, tenfold. But you want to confirm it, and of course you want to make sure that the patient's been adherent, because, you know, nothing will make a PCR test go up like a patient who stops taking their medication. If you also simultaneously with that detect a mutation that you know to confer clinical resistance to that medication, you know, I think irrespective of getting another bone marrow assessment, I think it could be justifiable to switch such a patient. But switching somebody just for a two or three-fold increase or some mutation that may not represent a true drug-resistant mutation, you know, I agree that that's not warranted. One thing I would say, just to speak to something that Susan mentioned, is there has been a lot of, maybe if you want to call it, mixed messages coming from the thought leaders in this field. This is also an area that's undergoing evolution, because these recommendations are essentially, they've been established with relatively short follow-up. Now, you might say, well, if you have a 60-year-old and you're pretty happy with having a complete cytogenetic response, or maybe even only a major cytogenetic response, but if you have somebody who's 18, like the first patient we discussed, and they have what you hope will be 50, 60 years of life ahead of them, you know, I think that in such a case, the data that's evolving is suggestive the deeper response in general, the better patients will do. And this will likely continue to evolve as we get longer follow-up with patients on TKIs. And all of these have been essentially established in the imatinib era. And what the second generation drug milestones are going to be is still in the process of being established, because the follow-up is really very short with those agents in the frontline setting.
You know, it's really amazing to talk to investigators like the two of you. There's just so much information. It almost becomes like a Talmudic discussion. I can really see the challenge oncologists taking care of renal cell and lung cancer and everything else, kind of trying to keep up with everything. And we try to pick out a few of the key points that maybe people could take away. And also looking at some of the practice surveys that have been done, ours as well as one that Mike Morrow reported at the ASCO meeting just last month. But maybe, Susan, if you want to comment a little bit on this issue of disease burden and these key tests that we're talking about.
Well, I think that this is a nice schematic to kind of show the depth of response that you have and that you can measure with each of the different tests. And the point is that once you get a complete cytogenetic response, which happens in the vast majority of patients, that's not a way to monitor anymore. And that's why we've moved to the RT-PCR. The issue is that we don't have very well-defined endpoints like we do for cytogenetics to say, if you don't have this molecular response at this point in time, we should change. And the reason we don't have that yet is because, again, with the follow-up that we have, mainly on imatinib, as Neil said, the molecular response doesn't appear to be quite as relevant as the complete cytogenetic response. I do think the other point Neil made that's very important, and I agree with him, is that all bets may be off when we go to using the second generation TKI first. Some of these guidelines are almost certainly going to change. If these are better drugs with quicker responses, then the endpoints that we're going to look at in terms of declaring somebody a failure or deciding to change therapy are probably going to be quite different.
So the issue of assays is something we talk about all the time in so many different tumors, you know, EML4 ALK and lung cancer, obviously ER and HER2 and breast cancer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I kind of try to keep my eye out for things that, you know, really are important that catch attention. And one of the things that you both mentioned was this issue of the international scale. And Mike Morrow's study found that about half of oncologists were not aware of it. Susan, can you just briefly explain what this is and what it means?
Yes, it means that each laboratory's results are a little bit different. And as you know, 3-log reduction is what we're generally talking about for a major molecular response. Well, in one lab, a 3-log reduction may come out to be 0.01, and another lab, it may come out to be 0.02. And so what the labs generally do will report what's a major molecular response based on standardization. And that's what you'll get from most academic labs. And that gives you a way to interpret the number that you have rather than just saying, which we do admittedly when we talk about it for simplicity, that, well, a 3-log reduction or less than 0.01 is generally a major molecular response. But there can be quite a bit of variation from lab to lab. I think an important thing to remember for people who are using commercial labs where they don't quite know what the standardization is at least the one thing that you can do is always use the same lab over and over. Because at least if you see changes where the PCR is going up or down and it's coming from the same lab, you can believe it's going up or down. If you get one value in one lab and one value in another, what might look like an increase in the PCR may not be an increase at all. So at least it's important to stick with the same lab.
So, Neil, what about the international scale specifically? I'm looking at an assay that came from a community-based setting, and they actually say in here, quantitative comparison with the international scale. So at least I see that. Is that what you're looking for in the report, some mention of the international scale?
Yeah, so the international scale was initially established by assessing 30 untreated chronic phase patients and averaging their results. Obviously, that was a finite resource that is now long gone. But in the wake of that, there have been attempts by a number of people to sort of standardize the tests that are available. And unfortunately, not everybody has yet come on board. But this issue of major molecular response was actually defined based upon a 3-log reduction from that initial baseline of 30 untreated patients. And so we now have the international scale to sort of supplant that, if you will. And so a 3-log reduction is believed to be equivalent to that major molecular response in the IRIS study. And that has been associated in various analyses with more favorable outcomes. And so, yes, there are PCR tests that are commercially available that do report on an international scale. And I would certainly say to any physician that has the opportunity to access such a commercial test to do so, because I think it takes a lot of the guesswork out of it, which is what it's designed to do.
So, Susan, you had pointed out to me this poster that Mike Morrow presented at ASCO, a survey of more than 500 U.S.-based oncologists, I guess fairly recently, although they didn't have the date on there. You can see in our survey, which we did last week, you know, it seems like a higher fraction of docs were talking about second-generation agents up front. But the other thing they asked about is what do they consider to be the primary goal of treatment? And I'm curious, you can see that the commonest answer was MMR or CMR, Susan. What do you consider the primary goal of treatment?
I consider the primary goal a complete cytogenetic response. Now, would I like to see a complete molecular response? Yes, of course I would. But as long as I have a complete cytogenetic response and I don't have a rising PCR, I am pretty happy with that response because we know that they can be maintained for many, many years. One of the issues in terms of looking at major molecular response and some of the data that you see suggesting that people who get one do better than people that don't is that when they're looking at major molecular response, yes versus no, the no is often including people who don't have a complete cytogenetic response. It's everybody else. And that's the problem with that type of analysis. Usually when you look at the analysis and then take the people who don't have a major molecular and look at the people who have a complete cytogenetic response versus those that don't, that's where you see the big difference in the outcome. So you can't just look at it simplistically as major molecular response, yes, no, because the no includes groups that we would clearly call failure based on not achieving a complete cytogenetic response.
So on this series, of course, we set it up to be right after ASCO, hoping there might be some data that we could talk about. I'm going to ask you both about some data that was presented at ASCO. Here's the initial IRIS study and the follow-up that really revolutionized the field. I think most people are familiar with the two papers last year in the New England Journal looking at nilotinib and dasatinib. But then, Neil, at ASCO, there were two follow-up reports looking at these studies with a 24-month follow-up. And I'll just, you know, show some of the data and ask you, Neil, to comment on it. First was the issue of MMR in the DeCision trial looking at nilotinib. Any comments on that?
Yeah, so this was from the ENSND study looking at the cumulative incidence of major molecular response in patients randomized to receive either nilotinib or imatinib. And what I think is encouraging is not only is there a notable difference at 12 months, but that gap between nilotinib and imatinib is maintained at 24 months. And so, again, we can debate whether complete cytogenetic response or major molecular response is a better endpoint, but it's certainly suggesting that deeper responses are occurring faster in these patients and in a higher proportion of patients on, in this case, nilotinib relative to imatinib.
So, Susan, again, in this ENIST-ND study, sorry, I didn't get that one right, any comments about the data they just presented at ASCO looking at accelerated phase blast crisis?
So we know that the trial has shown in the short-term follow-up a reduced transformation rate, and that's a very important clinical endpoint because if patients transform to accelerated or blast phase, we know that this is associated with a bad outcome. So this is very clinically relevant. I think that these differences may become minimized over time. And I say that because we know that with imatinib, the highest rate of progression to accelerated or blast crisis is generally in the first 2 or 3 years, and then it drops off very dramatically. But nevertheless, this is a very clinically relevant endpoint, although we're talking about a small minority of the patients compared to the total population.
And Neil, here are the comparable data again presented at ASCO looking at the DECISION trial that you've been so involved with. Maybe you can comment on this.
Yeah, so very similar to what you observed earlier with the molecular response data from the previous study. Again, differences, notable differences in favor of the second generation drug, in this case, dasatinib, at 12 months that are persisting at 24 months. So again, deeper remissions are occurring in a higher proportion of patients and they're occurring faster with the second generation drug. And this is showing you that this issue of transformation, there's also a hint here that the transformation is less in patients who are treated with dasatinib relative to imatinib. So one important thing to just put out there is there can be a tendency to compare these two studies because they both compared patients to imatinib, but of course they're not randomized with respect to each other. And the other thing is this issue of transformation, while it's gotten justifiable attention, it's not a trivial thing to decide when to censor patients for development of transformation. And there were differences in these studies in terms of how they defined transformation, how long they followed patients before censoring them. And so the numbers of patients are generally kind of small, and small differences one way or another can cause patients to be counted or not counted as transformation. So I agree with Susan that I certainly hope to see a more accurate picture of this with 36 to 48 months of follow-up, because we know that the majority of action happens with imatinib during that time period, and we'll be able to compare the second generation drugs a little bit more appropriately, I think, at that time.
So again, Susan, looking at randomized trials, we also have the intergroup study that was updated at ASCO, also looking at dasatinib. Anything that you want to say in terms of that, Susan?
Only to say that the data look almost identical to the DECISION trial, and so that's very comforting that another randomized trial by a large group found almost identical outcome in terms of comparing dasatinib to imatinib.
So before we go into our next topic, and in a couple of Susan's cases, to get into this issue of side effects and adherence, I want to give you a few questions that we're getting from the audience. These are really great questions. So Neil, let's start out with you. Here's the question. I've been treating a patient with CML for 10 years with imatinib. She remains stable with continued cytogenetic response. She asked about switching to nilotinib or dasatinib. Any reason to do this?
Assuming this is a complete cytogenetic response, I would say, you know, if this is a patient who is tolerating imatinib just fine without any concerning side effects, I would say there's probably not a compelling reason to switch such a patient. If this is a younger patient who wants to achieve a deeper molecular response with the assumption that that will translate to a better long-term outcome, I could see, you know, switching such a patient to a second generation drug for that reason. The good news is, of course, you're not burning any bridges. You always have the ability to go back to imatinib, and you know the side effect profile that the patient already has on imatinib.
So, Susan, this person didn't mention what the qPCR was. What are your thoughts about Neil's response?
I understand what he's saying. My answer would simply be, you don't mess with success.
Yeah, that's kind of the thought that was kind of going through my mind, but I can see the other rationale. So, Neil, here's another one. How do you explain a qPCR of 0.5% and a bone marrow cytogenetics of 2/20 metaphases positive for T922?
Yeah, so there can be discrepancies between PCR, FISH, metaphase analysis. I think that metaphase is what we probably have the most experience interpreting. One thing that can happen with PCR tests, again, if this is a send-out test to a commercial laboratory, the subject or the thing that's being reported on, that's being measured in the PCR test, is something that can degrade over time. And if it wasn't appropriately stored or processed in a timely fashion, you can get an artifactually low, I'm assuming this is a low PCR level, a lower PCR level than would be expected for 2 out of 20 Philadelphia chromosome positive metaphases. But I would be concerned, you know, if this is a patient who's been on for a year or 18 months and has been compliant or been adherent, I'd be concerned that this patient is not meeting the complete cytogenetic response milestone.
So before I go to Susan for her thoughts on this, can you just elaborate a little bit more, Neil, about this issue you mentioned of storage of the specimen?
Well, yes. Yeah, so the PCR test is designed to quantify the amount of BCR-ABL transcript within cells. Now, for reasons that are completely unclear to me, there is one commercial vendor out there that does this test on plasma. And because they can offer the test for less, I think many people who are in charge of making decisions about which test to order will order this particular plasma-based test. But it's very difficult for me scientifically to think of what is being meaningfully measured in the plasma. So I would encourage people to stick with cell-based assays. Nonetheless, RNA is by its nature very labile. There are enzymes that degrade RNA in cells, and so as these cells maybe start to die within the test tube before the RNA is extracted, the level of RNA can drop simply for that reason, and you can have somebody with what appears to be a very low transcript level as a result.
So I want to move into the issue of side effects and adherence, and Susan, you have two cases that I think sort of get this out on the table. Before you start going through them, Susan, agree, disagree, there's no other situation in oncology. There is no other situation in contemporary medicine where adherence is more critical than CML. Agree or disagree, Susan?
Agree.
Well, you know, maybe you're a little bit biased, but I'd like somebody in the audience to suggest a situation that's more critical than this one, but we'll get into why in a second. Susan, why don't you talk a little bit about your 58-year-old woman?
Yes, this is a patient of mine who has actually had CML for 20 years and was originally treated with Hydrea, homoharringtoning, which is now macitaxine in clinical trials, and interferon. And finally, she got on the commercial supply in September 2001 with imatinib 400. And she tolerated it reasonably well and had a good response, but then lost her cytogenetic response later. And because of that, at that time, nilotinib in 2005, which wasn't yet commercially available, we did have available on a trial. And so she was entered on this trial where she received 600 BID. And because there was a lot of cardiac monitoring and all sorts of monitoring that we probably wouldn't even do in real life, she at one point in time had a slightly elevated troponin. Now, this is a woman who has very severe diabetes also and diabetic retinopathy. I would have left her on the nilotinib, to be honest with you, but because of all the attention with QTC prolongations and the possibility of cardiac side effects, the patient had to come off study, which she did, and then went on dasatinib and had several problems with pleural effusion such that we had to come down on the dose. But actually right now is being maintained on 20 milligrams, so a markedly reduced dose of dasatinib, and she continues with a complete molecular remission, even at that reduced dose of only 20 milligrams a day. So a woman who's gone through many treatments and after 20 years happily has a very good response.
So Neil, before we start dissecting out some of the side effects and toxicity data, just sort of taking a step back in terms of the decision about initial TKI, suppose somebody were to say to you, well, how about imatinib? You know, why wouldn't I want to use it in this situation? What argument would you use to persuade them towards your point of view of, as you said, a coin flip between the other two?
Well, it must be stated that imatinib was a game changer, and with 8 years of follow-up, you know, more than half of the patients are in a very deep cytogenetic response at last assessment on the IRIS study. So for many patients, it's certainly adequate. Now, where we stand here in 2011 is that we don't have the follow-up with the newer drugs that we have with imatinib, but if we take the position that cytogenetic response is a surrogate endpoint for improved outcomes. You know, both these studies showed superior complete cytogenetic responses at 12 months relative to imatinib, and you've seen the molecular response data as well. And so I think that it's going to take a long time before we show the sort of impressive progression-free survival differences between these two agents, simply because patients are going to be doing reasonably well on imatinib as it is. I would say that many patients tolerate the second generation drugs better than imatinib. While we think of imatinib as a very well tolerated drug, let's remember that we compared it to interferon, which was a rather toxic agent, and now these newer agents are being compared with imatinib, and in many patients' eyes are actually better tolerated. And I think there's very little reason to suspect that patients are going to do more poorly on the second generation drugs. And so my feeling is there's enough data at the present time to justify, in my practice, preferentially starting a patient on a second generation drug. But I certainly would not criticize any physician who wanted to continue to start a patient on imatinib in the present time with newly diagnosed chronic phase CML.
So Susan, here are the updated data from the ENIST-ND study, and then we're going to show the decision study. These are the kinds of things that oncologists look at in terms of, you know, trying to figure out toxicity profiles. But there's also talking to people like you and just sort of saying, what do you actually see in terms of quality of life, in terms of the frequency of specific problems with all three of these drugs, Susan?
I mean, obviously, we know that grade 3 to 4 toxicities are minimal with all of them. On the other hand, if you're a patient who's going to be on a drug for years, grade 2 toxicity is going to get old. And my own experience is that with both of the second generation TKI, I think both of them are generally better tolerated than imatinib. There's less fluid retention, less cramps, less GI toxicity. And I think it's a nice thing that the drugs that we think are probably more effective, and so far do look to be more effective, actually also have less side effects.
So what kind of rash is seen, Neil, with nilotinib? Is it sort of the TKI kind of rash that oncologists are already familiar with?
Yeah, in general it is. I mean, it can involve, you know, more extensive areas of the body. It's generally not a huge symptomatic problem for patients, but if it does involve certainly more than 50% of the body, then it's of course recommended to switch therapy. But in most cases, it doesn't get that far. And that's one of the toxicities more common with nilotinib relative to imatinib. But in general, as Dr. O'Brien said, it does appear to be as well, if not better, tolerated in most patients' eyes than imatinib.
So, Susan, what about dasatinib, and particularly the pleural effusions with your patient had? Can you give more of a sort of clinical feel for typical presentation and management?
Yeah, I mean, usually they can be easily managed without thoracentesis or doing anything sort of that dramatic. What we tell the patients is if they get a cough or they feel a little bit short of breath, to let us know. So usually we'll detect them early. They'll say, oh, I have this dry cough. It's just not going away. You do a chest x-ray, they have an effusion. Generally, we'll hold, sometimes do a Medrol dose pack, wait till the effusion resolves, and then start at a lower dose. And it's interesting that with imatinib, you really have a very narrow dose range unless you're going to get to a level that's not going to be very effective. With the second generation TKI, my sense is going forward with the dose reductions we're doing, we're still seeing very good responses with significant dose reductions, much more so than you would see if you had to dose reduce imatinib like that. So again, the patient I just presented is only on 20 milligrams of dasatinib a day. Now, this is a patient, of course, who didn't start with hematologic disease. She started with just cytogenetic disease. So she's starting with a much lower tumor burden when she goes on it also. And that may be relevant too. But nevertheless, she's doing quite well at a relatively low dose.
So, Neil, any thoughts in terms of what the mechanism of why you see pleural effusions or edema with dasatinib?
Yeah, that's an area of investigation. So people have actually looked at whether these patients are less likely to respond well or more likely to respond well. It turns out they actually may have a higher response rate than patients who don't develop pleural effusions. The pleural effusions tend to be lymphocytic exudates. Another thing that's associated with better responses on dasatinib is the development of lymphocytosis, peripheral blood lymphocytosis. And whether there's a link between those two, whether dasatinib has some other mechanism of of action in addition to inhibiting BCR-ABL is an area of active study, but we really don't understand too much about the mechanism. You know, it does occur. It's almost uniquely a dasatinib-related toxicity. But, you know, as you can see from these numbers here, that, you know, it's 10% all grades, and it's essentially grade 1 and grade 2. So another way of looking at it is that the majority of patients are not having this toxicity, in which case their side effect profile tends to look, you know, substantially better than imatinib. But it's something to certainly be aware of and to have a high index of suspicion of in any patient that develops new dry cough or shortness of breath, as Dr. O'Brien mentioned.
So, Susan, actually, I think we'll skip your second case so we can get to the other topics. But I did want to share with you what these 25 oncologists said in terms of these more than 200 patients in their practices with TKIs. This obviously is not a study of any type, but more of a survey. But, you know, sort of supporting the fact that even with imatinib, most patients generally tolerate it well. Overall, globally, Susan, how do you look at these three drugs in terms of the fraction of patients that sort of cruise through, as opposed to those that you have to manage in terms of toxicity?
I think that the numbers that you see here are actually fairly representative. I think anywhere from 60 to 70% of patients really, as you said, cruise through. And then there's patients who have some toxicity. The one difference I might take with this slide is that I would say that some toxicity, and of course it depends how you define that, is probably a bit more common with imatinib, as I mentioned earlier, particularly in terms of cramps or edema. And then in terms of really significant toxicity, I think it's pretty minor with all of these drugs.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that both of you and your practices are 75 to 100 patients with CML. You know, you estimated a much higher number for problems with imatinib, more along the lines of around 30%. But I want to ask the audience, you know, we know that the average oncologist has around 10 patients with CML. But I want you to assume, audience, that you have 10 patients. Let's say that's the number in your practice right now who are on a TKI for CML, whatever the TKI is. What would you guess would be the number out of that 10 of patients who would have enough of a problem with adherence that it might theoretically threaten their outcome? And while they're estimating that, Neil, you know, you're in a tertiary center, I'm not sure how quite typical for this problem, but what's your assessment in terms of how often adherence is enough of a problem that you're concerned?
Well, it certainly does come up. I mean, we're sometimes referred patients because they've lost a response, and at the heart of it may be adherence, and it's obviously, it can be a difficult thing to try to tease apart. And then we are, of course, we do see some of our own patients that are diagnosed at our own medical center, and for one reason or another, you cannot seem to convince them of the importance of taking their medication. So this is, I think, another thing to keep in mind here is that as patients hear more and more about how well they're doing with time on therapy, the threat of their disease really becomes relatively diminished in their minds relative to the threat of side effects or the cost or just the sense that they don't want to be on a medication. So it really does require, you know, probably a little bit more hand-holding on the part of physicians to say, you know, you need to continue to take this very seriously. You know, yes, we have these great drugs, and yes, you can feel like so far you've dodged a bullet, but we can't assume that you can stop therapy without any untoward complications.
You know, it's interesting, Susan. You can see the audience here tonight kind of reflects the same predictions of the docs in practice as well as you two, that maybe 10 or 20% of patients have issues with adherence. And, you know, one of the people in our group looked at that and said, wow, that's pretty good, you know, 80 or 90% adherence. But, you know, again, CML is a little bit different, huh, Susan?
Yes, I mean, I'm not surprised by these results, but I think that, well, one question is, what does the doctor consider adherence? Because, you know, does the doctor think that if they miss their pills 10 or 20% of the time, that's adherence? Of course, we don't know the answer to that from this. So that's an important question. Adherence is somewhat relative. But let's say, you know, they assume that it's 95%. Then I think early on, it's not that surprising because these drugs aren't that toxic. And again, early on, patients can generally tolerate grade 1 to 2 toxicity. But if they're going to have to tolerate it year after year, it gets different. So I agree with Neil. For two reasons, sometimes as time goes on, is when you have to be more concerned about it because either the patient, as Neil said, is doing very well and they start to sort of not feel the significance of their disease, or they have mild but chronic toxicities where they're just kind of sick of them. Now, again, now you can probably switch to another TKI, but in the past, before we had the second generation, we really had to encourage some of these people to stay on the drug, even though they weren't having grade 3 to 4 toxicity, because they just got tired of it after a while.
So, Neil, we want to just touch quickly on a couple practical points about assessing adherence. You know, frankly, we're trying to sort of plant a seed in the minds of our viewers. I mean, oncologists have to deal with lots of patients on important oral medication, you know, capecitabine, as you were mentioning, you know, tons of different kinds of TKIs. And, you know, we kind of want to see if we can kind of push out a little bit the fact that obviously a patient with CML is a little bit different. So, Neil, we have what we call the Lisa Carey idea, which is in one of our breast cancer programs, North Carolina's Lisa Carey said, well, I don't say to my patient, you know, are you taking your medicine? I say, how many doses of medicine have you missed in the last couple of weeks? What are some of your sort of clinical pearls, Neil, that maybe you tell your fellows about how to assess adherence with CML?
Well, yeah, this is obviously an important issue as we've been discussing. And at least in my own practice, what I like to try to do is I like to try to what I call normalize the process of non-adherence, meaning, first of all, put the patient at ease that I'm not judging them and say something along the lines of, you know, most people have trouble remembering to take every last dose of medication. In an average month, how many pills do you end up missing for one reason or another? That's my way of approaching it. But this is another satisfactory one to ask, you know, how many times within the last couple of weeks. It should be clarified that this issue of adherence, we know clearly it has a substantial impact on outcomes in patients treated with imatinib, as we may discuss in just a moment. We don't yet have those studies for the second generation drugs, but I think we have to assume that if a drug isn't taken, of course, the patient's not going to do as well.
So I want to just briefly show you, you know, in the spirit of edutainment, you know, we like to get people's attention. One of the questions we asked the 25 docs was, were there any interesting or unusual or amusing answers you've gotten when you ask people, not just with CML, but in their practice, are you taking their medication? And I'll ask the audience, you know, if there are any ones that you want to add to this list. But Susan, here are some of the ones I thought were kind of interesting. The dog ate my medicine. My child threw the pills out the window on the turnpike. It interferes with my golf game. I'm assuming that was an LHRH agonist. I don't take a pill that's that color, and it inhibits my creativity. So we just kind of throw those out to you to just kind of get your attention a little bit. But Susan, what about the issue of how much adherence problems have to exist in terms of being concerned? Here are a couple of papers that, you know, attempted to correlate adherence, in this case with imatinib, with outcome. And there are obviously tons of studies like that in the literature, but the graphic, Susan, that caught my attention the most was this paper from the JCO when they broke patients down into greater or less than 90%. You can see what the MMR was. Any thoughts, Susan, about how many pills a month do you need to miss to be concerned?
Right. I mean, I think that's a very good point. And, you know, these are people who have to take pills every single day, in with nilotinib twice a day, and sometimes more than one pill, depending on what the TKI is. So you're right. You don't really have to miss too many pills to be less than 90%. And so I think that this was a very striking article, which really is something that is pointing out that it doesn't take a lot to miss to have a significant impact on the outcome.
So we want to finish up and talk about a couple other important topics in the field. But first, I got to throw out another question I just got from the audience. I think it's interesting. And actually, we know from talking to oncologists, this is actually a very common question, Neil, which is, can we ever stop treatment in patients who've been stable for years?
Well, that's an excellent question. And I say that just because I want to be on that first little bit where you have everybody say, that's an excellent question.
Yeah, right.
No, actually, that is
I like that one. That was good. We might have to keep that.
That is an excellent question. And so this is actually being studied right now. So first of all, it's a minority of patients that get to a level of disease response where even PCR fails to detect their disease repeatedly over a period of several years. And again, after about 5 years of imatinib therapy, we're talking about no more than maybe 5 to 10% of patients. Maybe it'll be higher with the second generation drugs that get to that level of deep remission. Now that doesn't mean that they can stop medication, but the French have done some studies where they've actually enrolled patients in a clinical trial and followed their PCR level after they volunteered to stop their medication on study. And what they've found is about 60% of patients can have a loss of, or do have a loss of that deep molecular response. So they test PCR positive once again, usually within 6 to 9 months. which on the one hand is rather disheartening. But if you're an optimist, you look at the other 40% who've now been out 3 years or so and continue to be PCR undetectable. And so there may be a population, a subpopulation of a subpopulation that can stop medication, but at the present time, we don't know whether this is safe to do in the long term, whether it's going to encourage the eventual outgrowth of resistant disease. So at the present time, the recommendation is continuing therapy unless you want to go on a protocol to really try to address this.
So there are a couple other topics we want to address, again, getting at them through your cases. The first is the issue of disease progression, mutations, and new agents. And to get into that, Neil, maybe you can present your case.
Yeah, so this is a woman who came to see us a couple of years ago who had been diagnosed at the age of 43 with typical chronic phase CML. She was a little bit unusual in that she had some significant constitutional symptoms, some night sweats. She, interestingly, did not have a bone marrow assessment. She was seen at an academic center, but not at my own. And she was started on imatinib and rapidly achieved a hematologic response, but developed recurrence of her constitutional symptoms as well as leukocytosis just 9 months down the road, despite being adherent with medication. And at that time, she was switched to a second-generation drug. It was dasatinib. And she had a BCR-ABL kinase domain mutation test to try to figure out the reason that she had lost response to imatinib. And after 2 weeks, she had really no subjective improvement or improvement in her leukocytosis on dasatinib. And the mutation test came back positive for a mutation, the BCR-ABL T315I mutation, which is known to be cross resistant to all three approved kinase inhibitors. So she was offered a 9 out of 10 allogeneic stem cell transplant at that institution. She investigated that we were doing a clinical study with an investigational third generation kinase inhibitor called ponatinib, and she came on that study and actually achieved a very rapid complete cytogenetic response and a deep molecular response as well, and is now 2.5 years on that study and really thankful that she's on it at the moment.
So, Susan, I like the colors in this slide, and I think there's an important point in there, but maybe you can comment a little bit about the issue of mutation testing. One of the things that Mike Morrow picked up in his survey was, I think it was about 30% of oncologists were testing patients at diagnosis. When do you do this test, and what does it mean, and what does this graphic mean?
Well, basically, you only do the test when the patient is failing therapy. There's no point in doing it at diagnosis, and there's no point in doing it in a patient who has a very good response because you're not going to find a mutation. So don't bother to look then. Look at a time point when the patient is having an inadequate response or is losing their response. I think the graphic here just shows us that, unfortunately, right now, all of the commercially available TKIs do not have very much activity against the T315I. And so Neil's patient was lucky enough to get on a trial with a new TKI, ponatinib, that you heard about. That's only available on clinical trial. Although, as I guess we're going to see from the data that was recently presented at ASH, this data looks quite encouraging, and I think that this drug will become commercially available. But right now, having a T315I is a difficult problem since all of the commercially available drugs are just not very good at treating it.
So we want to get onto Susan's case in a second of an accelerated phase CML to close out. But Neil, any thoughts about not just ponatinib, but some of the other TKIs that are coming along?
Yeah, well, so this T315I mutation was actually the first mutation that was documented 10 years ago in a patient that lost response to imatinib at UCLA. And all these years later, we still don't have an approved therapy for this one mutation. We pretty much have, you know, effective treatment options for all the other mutations. But so it's nice to finally have something investigational for this. But, you know, as will be the case, some patients may have trouble tolerating one particular agent. And so there is another agent that's a kinase inhibitor called DCC2036, which is in a clinical trial that's also designed to deal with this particular mutation. There hasn't been efficacy data really presented with that yet. And then there's omisataxine, which is not a kinase inhibitor, protein synthesis inhibitor, which is some activity. It's also investigational. So hopefully between these three in the coming years, physicians will actually have, you know, a number of choices for patients who are unfortunate enough to develop this one particular mutation.
So let's finish out, Susan, with your case, the 40-year-old man, and we'll briefly touch on the issue of accelerated phase CML.
Right. He actually presented in 02 with high-risk disease. You see very high white count, platelets over 1 million, slight increase in blasts, but was still in chronic phase and initially had a nice response to imatinib 600 milligrams daily on a clinical trial, had some side effects, but managed to achieve a complete cytogenetic response, However, about 2 years later, lost that response. And in fact, because he lost the response, we looked for mutation and found an E355A mutation. Initially, we tried to increase the imatinib dose because at that time we didn't have second generation TKI to give him. But then a trial opened with nilotinib, 400 milligrams BID. This is back in 2005. Interestingly, when he went on that, he also had clonal evolution, which is why I called him accelerated phase with an isochromosome 17. When he went on nilotinib, all of the common side effects that we do see with imatinib disappeared. He had absolutely no side effects with nilotinib. He very rapidly achieved a response. And in fact, in 2006, he achieved a complete molecular response, so no evidence of disease by PCR, that he's now maintained for over 5 years.
So, Neil, any comments on the case?
I think this speaks to the power of how you can use tests to guide therapy. Now, in this particular case, this mutation that was detected is not one of the more common ones that's been associated with imatinib resistance, but it's also one that we don't know of to be associated with loss of response to the second generation drug. So I think either second generation drug could have been an excellent choice for this particular patient. And with the large number of mutations that are out there, it can become rather daunting to really know how to optimally treat patients. But I think what I try to advise physicians is just try to become aware of the ones that you know are clinically problematic for each of the second generation drugs. And there's only five or six that have been shown to cause loss of clinical response to nilotinib or dasatinib. And if a patient has one of those, then you can guide your treatment appropriately.
So I've got to finish out on my favorite topic, adherence, and ask you, Susan, I'm just kind of curious. It's interesting that this patient sounds like, quote, he cruised through nilotinib, you know, without any side effects, is based on what you're saying. How often do you see this, Susan, with the three TKIs, you know, kind of off the top of your head? What fraction of patients with each of the three kind of cruise right through therapy?
I think it's higher, as I've mentioned, for both nilotinib and dasatinib. I think it's the majority, I'm going to say 90%, maybe 85%, because you do have that 10% effusions with dasatinib that, again, are usually easy to deal with. I think cruising on imatinib is much less likely. Almost everybody has some degree of cramps. Again, having a sporadic cramp is not that big a deal. Some people have them quite frequently. Almost everybody has some amount of edema, particularly periorbital edema, which, you know, if you're interested in your looks, can be pretty bothersome. So these are minor things compared to the old days with interferon, but they do bother people. So I think these annoying things that prevent people from cruising through are much more common with imatinib and much less common with the second generation TKIs.
So on that note, I'd like to thank Neil and Susan and thank you for participating in this conference. Again, I'll send out an email in about a week announcing the rebroadcast of this program, and hopefully we'll be back in the not too far future with another series of webcasts. Have a great night.